General Anthony Zinni, U.S. Marine Corps retired, former Commander-in-Chief of U.S. Central Command and former U.S. Special Envoy to the Middle East. His latest book is Before the First Shots Are Fired, How America Can Win or Lose Off the Battlefield. General, it's a pleasure to have you in the studio.
Good
Thank
to be
you for
with
joining
you.
Me today. In the beginning of this book, you talk about your story in going to Vietnam in 1970. It's your second tour there. President Nixon is withdrawing troops from Vietnam. What did you see and learn there that informed your career later and that you see perhaps parallels in current events today, General?
Well, you know, what I saw was obviously the troops on the ground were doing a fantastic job under difficult situations. We were winning basically every firefight. We weren't winning the war. And so the real question had to be, why aren't we able to win a war when you can virtually win every battle? And as a young officer, a lieutenant, and then a captain in Vietnam, I mean, these were issues that were far above the kinds of things I thought about at that time. But I had spent my first tour with the Vietnamese and lived in the villages and spoke to the people. And it really hit home to me that I saw a different kind of war than my contemporaries that were within U.S. units. And I saw it from the perspective of the people all over Vietnam. And they were looking for something, as one Vietnamese lady told me in a village that we had moved into. They wanted to know what to die for. They looked at a government back in Saigon that had rotating generals committing coups every other month. They saw the corruption. And they saw us there in a major way. And so basically they thought that government belonged to us. They wondered what we were trying to do. And so for me, I started to see the connection from the operational part of this and the tactical part to something bigger and beyond, which I later would realize it's the strategic and the policy. And I think it was the first time I began to realize that if you don't have these all aligned, if they're not sort of nested in each other from the tactical to the operational to the strategic to the policy, then and they get out of whack, then you've got a problem. You can't win. You can't shoot your way to victory if you have a lousy strategy.
You write at the end of the first chapter of this book, before the first shot is fired, we must be sure everything we have analyzed, planned, and decided puts that Lance Corporal, a gentleman about whose story you tell earlier in the chapter, in the best position to succeed. His battlefield should be shaped to give him every advantage before he steps onto it. And you go on to detail in this book that you're not just referring to the military aspects of that shaping of the battlefield, sir.
Right. A true strategy is more than just a military plan. And I really feel strongly that if we don't look at the political, the economic, the social aspects, the informational aspects, all the elements of power, all the agencies of government that can contribute to this, the international community, if it's not all in sync, if it's not all coordinated, and we over-rely on the military, we end up being one-punch fighters, and the military solution is usually not the total solution. Our military finds itself, unfortunately, trying to do these other things. We don't have the capacity, really, in our other agencies and departments of government to be able to handle the task. And we've seen this in everywhere from Vietnam to Somalia to Iraq to Afghanistan.
The nexus of statecraft in warfighting, what are the components of a healthy, productive nexus of those two elements?
I think it's important that the military understands how their plan, their operational design on the ground, will meet the political objectives. That's the key link. You have political objectives when you have a strategy that articulates them very well, that expresses the threats, the national interests that are at stake. I would say that our greatest moment in history was back in World War II, where we had that bridge very effectively, where men like Marshall and Eisenhower and then the leadership of an FDR or a Truman, the Kennans of the world who thought strategically. You know, we had an era there during the Second World War and immediately afterwards where we had great strategic thinkers that were influencing government decisions. We were not only thinking and acting strategically, we had the military and all the other elements of government tied in with this. If you think about the National Security Act of 1947, the Marshall Plan, the creation of NATO, the IMF banks, you see economic, political, military decisions creatively done based on a principle set of strategies that were all locked in and were all aligned.
You write in this book, it's a rhetorical question to begin, and then you do go about the task of answering it. Why, in fact, has our military been actively engaged since World War II so often in so many parts of the world? Why have we gone to war so often? What is the premise under which you answer that question, and then talk about the answers you deliver there, sir?
Well, I think that the military is the easiest element of power to employ, strangely enough. You would think it would be a last resort, but it's the easiest. It's the biggest, it's the strongest, it's the most powerful. And I think sometimes presidents and political decision makers resort to it too quickly. We don't often think through the causes belli, you know, what is the reason for us going to war? What are the triggering events? And then I think sometimes presidents don't get a full range of options to really understand what else might be done before you make that decision, what else should be done that maybe complements that decision in some way and maybe takes the pressure off the military piece or allows the military piece to do its part but very quickly transition over to something that's non-military but in the end more productive and leads more towards success.
And maybe we'll even step back a step or two before the place that you're talking about, as you detail in this book, before the first shots are fired, and talking about setting the stage diplomatically and developmentally so that potential situations are diffused before they ever come to a conflict situation in the first place.
Well, absolutely. You know, I think you know, the art, the skill and art of diplomacy is very important, that it be used effectively. You know, I give you a good example today, the Ukraine. I think everybody admits there's no military solution to the Ukraine problem. You could find yourself through a series of missteps or misunderstandings in some sort of military dust-up, which everybody, I think, on both sides or three sides want to avoid. So here, diplomacy is the main effort, and diplomacy has to find a way to work. Now, that diplomacy probably has to be backed up by a strong military statement. Now, that could be a strong statement coming out of NATO showing cohesion, U.S. leadership, resolve on part of the Europeans, willingness to go to sanctions, reaffirm the commitment in NATO, you know, attack on ones, attack on all. So there are military aspects of it, but they're nonviolent aspects initially. And that's sort of a backdrop or a reinforcement to the diplomatic effort. But the diplomatic effort goes first.
That reinforcement, though, comes from a position where any one of the involved parties is able to say we're prepared and we're serious. And the preparation one is a piece that the Joint Chiefs, the Chiefs of Staff have talked about extensively. General Dempsey's talked about readiness on a number of occasions, given the budget discussions and hearings in Congress. And so one could understand where a mixed message may be coming out of the United States by people looking at us around the world and saying maybe they're not as ready as they'd like us to think they are.
I think it's a moment in history when we're being tested. I think Putin's objective is to test to see if American leadership is as strong as it's been in the past, especially in Europe. You know, he's also testing European resolve. I think groups like ISIS and others that are destabilizing and now causing the problems that we see happen are looking at testing our leadership, the ability to pull together a coalition, to be able to execute and to manage it, to see if we have the power, military and otherwise, and can deploy it and exercise it. Are we cut too thin? Is it too difficult for us to do? Can we handle multiple missions? Is our leadership still powerful enough to create coalitions, to get the UN to provide a resolution that gives us international legitimacy and authorize the use of force? I think these are serious questions. Those that potentially want to compete with us or counter us in some way are asking themselves, and may be willing to test it in some cases.
In chapter two of this book, you write about a conversation with General Hugh Shelton, the former chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, talking about his wish for an experienced four-star to sit on the National Security Council to advise the President of the United States. And this gets at the theme that goes throughout this book of the interaction between or among diplomatic, developmental, and defense officials. And I love this term. He made it clear that he didn't want a political or chateau general in that position. What's a chateau general, sir?
Well, I don't know if you've ever read the book Once an Eagle, but and many of us have, and it's kind of almost biblical in terms of military officers growing up in that era. And it describes two generals. You know, one is Sam Damon, who's a warrior. The other's Courtney Massengale, who's a political general, spends a lot of time in Washington, you know, curries favor with seniors. So I think what I felt that Hugh Shelton wanted was a real warrior, a Sam Damon, to ensure that people making these decisions wearing suits and skirts with not a lot of military experience has someone in there who can clearly describe what the military needs out of this, the policy and the strategy, also describe how that translates to battlefield actions and what it means down even to the tactical level. So that discussion, that input is in the room when these things are being decided and analyzed.
Is that the role, though, of someone like General Shelton and the other chiefs?
I think what General Shelton realized very clearly is there is probably a deliberation process that goes on before he's invited into the room. And so I think his concern was ideas get formed, decisions start to set before maybe you bring in all the pieces of government. Maybe the cabinet's called in, the principals, the deputies. So he thinks right at the beginning, at the onset of a triggering event, at the onset of beginning to think about options and doing the analysis, he wanted somebody in the room, and he was clear about this. He didn't want it to be perceived as a spy from him or representing him. Mm-hmm. This was to belong to the president and the National Security Council, however the president shapes his decision-making structure, to be involved in that. So that consideration comes in from the initial onset and even before he gets there. It's not to supplant his role in any way.
In Chapter 8 of this book, you propose a change to the makeup of the JCS. You write, it should be a standing body made up of former service chiefs and former combatant commanders, italicized former on both parts. On a final tour of duty, this would bring to that body much broader experiences and much richer joint experience and would encourage uninhibited opinions and advice. It would still retain its purpose as an advisory body. What's the benefit that, or benefits that the President of the United States would derive from that revised structure that you put out there?
Well, first of all, when the Joint Chiefs of Staff were created, I think there was a different definition of joint. Joint just meant all the services were represented in the room. Now jointness has a different meaning. Ever since Goldwater-Nichols, we have a series of joint commands, you know, headed by four stars. Some are regional, some are functional. Those nine commands really see the operational side of this. The service chiefs, who are now the joint chiefs, they are providers. They are trained, organized, and equipped Title 10 directed senior officers. The element of employment and integration that's out there in the field is not represented in the Joint Chiefs of Staff. So I think that kind of mix is necessary. I really believe the service chiefs do a great job, but they have a day job, and it's a consuming one. So when they have to come into the tank at the Pentagon to discuss an issue of employment of forces, I don't think they really have the depth of knowledge. They're providers. They're not employers of the force or even integrators of the force. And so that aspect has been left out in sort of the advice and the decision-making and the analysis, I believe, in Washington.
General Tony Zinni is author of the book, Before the First Shots Are Fired. You mentioned General George Marshall earlier in our conversation, sir, and you cite him in this chapter about the new battlefield once again, this time about the development of new leaders. So we'll move back from the Joint Chiefs a generation or two and think about the development that he was successful at laying the groundwork for the leaders who were your superiors in Vietnam and beyond. What did General Marshall do so well, or what eye did he have, that he was so successful at building a new generation of leadership in the military?
Well, when Marshall was Chief of Staff of the Army, every time he visited somewhere, one of his personal missions was to identify what he believed would be some high-quality officer that could go on to greater responsibility, that had that sort of strategic mindset, that expressed that kind of leadership, that capacity to run large organizations, the creativity, the knowledge. And, yeah, there was always this, whether it's true or not, that he kept a black book. I believe whether he kept a physical black book or not, he kept one in his head. And he certainly was able to, in World War II, with uncanny accuracy, pick the leaders that could step up and command units that weren't even imaginable before the war that would be in our structure. We suddenly had Corps, Army, Field Army commanders when before the war, you know, we had a very small a standing military. The Army was the 17th largest in the world behind Romania. I think that's a mark of a good leader. I've seen it in other services. In my own service in the Marine Corps, the Commandant General Al Gray had that. And I think I've seen others that look at the future of their service and look for people that they feel can step up beyond what you're seeing now and have that potential. It's not just the capacity to lead from an organizational perspective. It's the imagination and creativity and the ability to think analytically to get things done that I think convinces those leaders that they can analyze and think through in a way that solves problems on a large scale and that are very complex.
You write about General Marshall. Junior officers he brought forward for promotion included Dwight Eisenhower, Omar Bradley, George Patton, Maxwell Taylor, and Matthew Ridgway. That's a pretty good list.
That's a pretty good list, and it's not comprehensive. There's many, many more that he saw there.
Were the tactics that he applied to decide who he wanted to, who he saw talent in, were they subjective or objective in your view? And is that an eye that someone else can develop, or do you just have to have a knack for it?
I think part of it was intuitive. When I'm around very creative thinkers or people that are able to see things from a strategic point of view, a holistic point of view, and maybe rise above to get this sort of systems way of thinking about things, all the parts, they tend to be able to identify people that can step up and move into a level like that. I've seen that in people like Colin Powell and others that can identify individuals that can work and lead at that level. Not everybody can. I mean, I've seen studies that involve people in leadership positions in business, government, elsewhere, military. And some of those studies say as little as 4% of the people really possess that kind of capability to think and act and execute strategically. Some are great operators. They can operate day to day. They're very good at the transactional side. But to step up to that level is unique. And it, you know, usually it's a very few that have that capability and capacity.
What are the mistakes that you're seeing looking outside the Pentagon in developing the next generation of leaders across the agency?
Some of it, I think, has to do with lack of military representation in the strategic decision-making process. I think there's a tendency to say, well, if you're in a uniform, you're sort of pigeonholed, you belong in the Pentagon or out in the field. But when you think about our greatest moments in our history, the generals were brought in to the strategic decision-making process. Again, Marshall's a great example. Colin Powell was a great example. And, you know, he was chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff under President Bush, H.W. Bush. Yet you can be certain he was involved in the strategic and policy-making decisions. And so I think that there has to be a place for those generals that can do that. Eisenhower in his Solarium group that provided advice when a crisis was faced, he had two generals in there. Actually, they were major generals. They weren't three or four stars. And, you know, so there's a time when you find somebody wearing a uniform but able to think beyond the operational into the strategic and policy level. And I think, again, having them as part of that decision-making process, it worries me when I see the civilian leadership that we respect so much and certainly want to have in control of our military that maybe doesn't have the experience and doesn't seek the experience and those that they might trust that have the experience and bring them into that process.
The passage from your book that I think of as you describe that, sir, is your interpretation of the photographs that came out of the Situation Room as Osama bin Laden was apprehended and killed. And I'm paraphrasing here, and I hope I'm not putting words in your mouth, but the interpretation interpretation that I took away from reading your view of that was there were a whole group of people there, are the very highest levels of our government, who weren't really quite sure what they were looking at on the screen.
No, I know, and that's not their fault. I mean, I'm not a believer that, you know, a president has to have military experience or congressman. I think that military experience needs to be in our leadership to some level. But if you don't have it, you know, it's difficult for them to translate those decisions at that level down to an understanding of how that works on the ground at the tactical level. What you want in that room is somebody that's able to take the tactical evolutions that are taking place that you might not have a true sense or feeling because your lack of experience, you can't relate to it, and then be able to lead it up to those strategic decisions. You know, I would give you an example. I've heard people criticize a period in time when, you know, we were looking for Osama bin Laden. This is before 9/11. And there were all sorts of people in the White House saying, you know, send in special operations forces to do this and do that. And why aren't they doing it? And I remember having a conversation that was very frustrating for the commander, the special operations command at that time. And he said, they just don't understand. You need specific intelligence. You know, you just don't send out SOF forces and say, well, go to Kandahar and find Osama bin Laden. It doesn't work that way. But, you know, you can see where people don't have the understanding of the requirements on the ground to be successful, to really understand this is a very highly skilled, very highly trained people that require very specific intelligence, stealth, and skill at a level that has to be met by information that they need on the ground to ensure success.
Strategy formulation via television and movies, it sounds like.
Well, yeah. I mean, I think everybody has these wild images and really doesn't understand the level of professionalism that certainly those forces possess. And what their requirements are to succeed. You know, our whole SOF community was born out of Desert One, which was a miserable failure for a lot of reasons. And a part of it, we didn't have some of the capabilities and capacity. You know, unfortunately, there we had the intelligence. We couldn't execute. You know, this is a finely tuned machine. Timing, skill levels, high degree of specific intelligence, the need for these things to succeed really push for requirements that are, you know, computed down to very specific things that are required for success on the ground.
We touched on the concept of the new battlefield earlier in our conversation, sir, and you devote a chapter to it in the book, as I mentioned. In that chapter, you write, today our enemies tend not to be nation states, but movements or international and local gangs. Combat power counts less. The narrative counts more. We have rules. The enemy doesn't. How does that change your role as you go into a situation as a warfighter, given that all of the things that we've talked about up till now haven't been successful and there's a conflict presenting itself?
Well, you know, when you have two sides, that, you know, we've tried to, in some ways, codify warfighting. It's always been difficult, despite the Hague Convention, the Geneva Conventions, and the rules of war, the law of land warfare. You know, there's a lot of it out there. In some conflicts, it's respected, in some it's not. In the current environment, it rarely is. We have to think about our own set of values, and you know, even though it may put us at a disadvantage at some times, it's more important that we retain our sense of moral, ethical responsibility. And that makes it more difficult for our troops. I did assessments in Iraq and Afghanistan. I saw times when the rules of engagement, I thought, were too strict and actually inhibited our troops from accomplishing the mission or providing self-protection. So we have to be very careful with that. We have to understand that certainly we invest a lot in preventing casualties and creating collateral damage. The amount of money we put into an investment in technology and precision weapons and intelligence, I think, speaks for itself in that area. The way we monitor, you know, our staff judge advocates monitor our target lists and everything else to ensure we're in compliance with the just war theory, you know, proportionality. The targeting is done in a way where we value the importance of minimizing collateral damage, destruction of historic or religious sites. You know, it goes on and on and on. We fight an enemy that doesn't respect that. And we have an enemy right now in ISIS that will commit genocide in a heartbeat, almost did in several instances, or will commit horrific acts in TV. That's their narrative. That recruits and helps radicalize people that they need. That's a different audience that we're appealing to.
We see, though, thankfully, signs of pushback. There are some of the cities in Iraq where ISIS has done some of its most awful, gruesome things. And we're seeing reports of pushback where the citizens say, you know what, this isn't what the kind of Islamic caliphate that we signed up for, and are starting to push back a little bit. Do you expect to see more of that as the killing for killing's sake becomes more evident in some of the groups that we're fighting?
Yes, I think certainly I'm seeing, and I follow this pretty closely. It doesn't get a lot of attention. I'm seeing a lot of Islamic religious leaders now really stepping up and condemning this, issuing fatwas, condemning it, and other things. If you understand Islam, it's not like Christianity. There isn't a council of bishops or a pope or anything like that. It's a lot of individual interpretation, and it's very segmented. But there is now this blowback on the horrible set of conditions, then attributing it and justifying it to Islam, has caused that. So I think it will work against them in the long run. And it may even be the case where, villages and towns and cities will stand up to them, and tribal groups will stand up to them for fear it may happen to them, and not wanting to succumb to that and not wanting anybody to believe they support that form of interpretation of that religion. So, in the long run, I think that does not help their cause. It was, when Al-Qaeda tells you you're going too far, that's really saying something. It will in the end create a sense in the international community of horror, and that will allow support. Certainly, we've seen our own public opinion begin to shift as they see these horrific scenes, more supporting the need for us to take action.
How I'm going to shift gears here quite a bit in the time that we have left, General. How has cyber defensive and offensive capability changed the way that you prepare for and execute kinetic conflict?
When I left active duty, and this is now 14 years ago, but when I was the commander of U.S. Central Command, tensions would mount for one reason or another. Maybe you're deploying forces, things are happening on the ground. Nobody's fired a shot yet. And I would be getting reports about our systems being hit, classified systems, our unclassed systems. And every day as the tensions mounted, before there was even a shot to ring out or a kinetic energy expended, it struck me we were already at war in cyberspace. And I don't think we've come a long way in trying to understand what that means, but the war may have already begun. But it's involved in a domain that's not kinetic, and I don't think we have really thought about the rules. I mean, we are not permitted to counterattack just based on an attack. We can counterattack in the cyber world if the consequences warrant it. But why not just the attempt to attack us be the cause sufficient enough for us to counterattack? So there are questions like this that I had that are still yet to be resolved. Your systems now, we're so dependent on these systems, not just the military, but everything that we have. We are vulnerable in these systems. I mean, our healthcare system, our economic system, our national security is all dependent upon a secure cyber world for us. We need to assure access, and we need to assure protection in this area. And I think this is still a work in progress, and it's very difficult because there are a lot of people trying to get into our systems and cause mayhem. I experienced this in the business world. I was chairman of the board of BAE Systems and the CEO for a while, and I know we had significant attempts to penetrate our systems and constantly had to work with the government and Defense Department on ensuring everybody understood this, and we mutually banded together for our protection.
You quote General Mike Hayden, a former head of the CIA and National Security Agency, in the book, as calling the cyber domain a man-made, ungoverned digital Somalia.
Yeah, Mogadishu, I think he said.
That's not a very that's not a very optimistic picture.
No, and you know, for somebody like Mike Hayden, who really understands that world, when they tell you something like that, it's unsettling.
The future of cyber, is it dependent on establishing that set of rules or protocols before we can move confidently forward, either from a defensive or a proactive capability?
I think several things have to happen, and certainly I'm no expert in this area, but I do believe we need to get a set of laws now that defines what we can and can't do and assures our protection, assures our access. That's difficult because no one wants to, this gets into freedom of speech and other things. So there are other issues in there, other freedoms that make it harder to work around this. But we need to get some sort of discipline into this system, some sort of regulation and some sort of understanding. Secondly, we need to find the state-of-the-art ability to protect these systems. That prevent attacks and some way to counter these attacks very effectively and immediately to ward off any damage that could be done from picking up our information or preventing us from sharing it or in some way disabling the systems we rely on so much. I mean, in many ways, cyberspace to me is like the oceans of the world were maybe a century or two centuries ago. You know, we always talked about in terms of the sea, we had to have access and denial. Those were the two kinds of operations. Cyberspace is another domain in which access and denial are still the same. So it's another domain, not physical, not geographic in that sense, but the requirement is still the same.
In the time that we have left, I would like to do a little bit of word association.
Okay.
I'm going to throw at you some of the conflict points around the world, and I would like to get your vision of what a solution looks like. Maybe not the optimist the optimal solution for the United States, but something that would mean the most to the people that are living in these places. We talked about the situation in Ukraine earlier. Mm-hmm. What do you see there as a solution that would work best for Ukrainians?
Well, I think first you have to look at what Putin's trying to do. Putin is trying to do two things in my mind. One is to test American leadership. Is it still viable? Is it still effective? Is it in Europe? Secondly, he's trying to test European resolve and cohesion. If NATO stands up to the challenge, the European Union stands up to the challenge, if they're willing to impose harsh sanctions and stand together, if it's demonstrated that America still is the leader in this area, I think Putin will then look for a graceful way, a face-saving way out. Then I think it's incumbent upon us to manage that. Again, diplomatically, how do we get this ratcheted back and stepped down? The president of Ukraine impresses me as somebody that really wants to make this thing go away in a way where, you know, no one feels compelled to do something rash. And so he seems like a reasonable, rational person. So I think that, you know, if we demonstrate our resolve on this end, if NATO does, America's leadership still intact, Europeans will hang together and will deliver if necessary. I think you could see this thing walk back diplomatically.
I have Iraq and Syria on my list, but I wonder if because of the emergence of ISIS, we maybe must consider those two countries together as far as a potential solution because of the overlap of that structure.
I would break them apart because I think Iraq and Syria are two different issues. ISIS happens to maybe bring that out. But, you know, the first thing to do with ISIS is get them the heck out of Iraq. That should be the immediate task in whatever strategy the president's going to go through. But once they get them out, there is another strategic design that's necessary for Iraq. The restructuring of their government to be more inclusive. The new government, the post-Maliki government, has to reach out to the Sunnis, make them feel that there will be sharing of resources, sharing of power. They'll be inclusive in the government structure in a meaningful way. And then what's key is deciding what kind of Iraq would emerge out of this. It may look more like the United Arab Emirates. It may be three sort of entities, counting the Kurds and the Sunni provinces and the Shia provinces, that are bound together in some sort of federation but still have a lot of autonomy and decision-making and resource allocation on their own. In terms of Syria, I really believe Syria is going to split. I think you're going to see the Alawites and the Christians retain one area. I think you're going to see something else, some sort of entity, a Sunni entity of some sort, control the others. What we would like to ensure is if anything like that occurs, it should be a moderate Sunni, the Free Syrian Movement. Right now, that's contested. And then that is the sanctuary for ISIS, which we can't allow to exist.
And Assad out of the picture?
Well, it's, you know, Assad may not go out of the picture. He may still be in some form in charge of that rump part that is the Alawite and the Christian and several other entities that are sort of tribally and ethnically and religiously bound to that to him.
South China Sea and all of the conflicts that China seems to be picking with its neighbors down there.
Yeah, I think we, you know, I think China is getting a little adventuresome. I think, you know, this calls for us to make sure we have a strong naval presence out there, that we stand firm behind our allies out there, Japan, South Korea. So China knows what the rules are out there. I don't think China wants to go into a contest, a military contest with us, and I don't mean a shooting war, but they saw what happened to the former Soviet Union trying to get into an arms race with us. Economically, it was disastrous, and politically, it was disastrous. They have bigger fish to fry in terms of economic superiority, education superiority. I think they see that as a clear path. I think they make these gestures just to ensure we know they feel they're the hegemon in the region and the power. And we're going to be required to demonstrate that, you know, we can counter it and we will, and we're not accepting that. And that's the game right now, I think.
You go into great detail about your position on the strategic shift to the Pacific and why you think that's not the optimal choice for the United States in the book. And I'm sorry we don't have time to talk about your position there, General. Finally, Afghanistan, the problem child for the American military now, longest war in our history.
Yes, and the key right now is that these two competitors for the head of state position need to resolve their differences. I know we've been leaning on them very heavily, but we need to get on with a governance system that can work. This constant contesting the elections have been done, they've been set. They may not have been perfect, but there needs to be an acceptance. And I think they need to work together and reach out to each other and find a way of accommodating each other. If this goes on and on and on, it's going to continue to fracture the government and the country. And that doesn't sit well. I mean, we see what happened in Iraq with Maliki, and in the long term, how that affected the stability of the country. So I think there needs to be a lot of diplomatic pressure on these two guys to resolve their differences, find a way they can accommodate each other, get on with the government, clean the government up, which is key, make it more responsive, which would invite our help, technical help, economic and support for their security forces, security assistance program. But right now, that's the most dangerous thing that's happening.
General Anthony Zinni with his colleague Tony Koltz, author of Before the First Shots Are Fired, How America Can Win or Lose Off the Battlefield. Thank you very much, General.
Thank you, Francis.